Council Committee. It is May 30th, 2003, 1 p.m. We're in Hearing Room B. Has everyone read the minutes? I need a motion for approval of the minutes.
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of the minutes from the April 4th, 2003 meeting.
Representative Williams moves we adopt the minutes from the April 4th, 2003 meeting. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. Possible reconsideration of requests for cooperation in drafting of citizens' initiatives.
Madam Chair, in my consultation with the Speaker earlier this morning, she is not intending to move her motion for possible reconsideration.
Thank you very much, Representative Williams. Okay. Greg, go ahead under administrative rule review, please.
Thank you. With the chair's indulgence, I thought I'd provide a very brief state of the office report. I'm pleased to report that you all are exercising some substantial restraint in the number of measures and amendments that you're requesting, which is very helpful given that our budget and the number of people who work in the office is down as a result of the sixth special session. We were pleased to contribute $60,000 to the general fund to conclude the 0103 biennium. As a reminder, or to follow up on the note about a lack of funds, please don't leave with your notebook and don't leave with the neat colored dividers in your notebook. If you want the materials, please give your notebook to Ms. Rollman at the conclusion of the meeting, and she will extract the dividers and keep the notebook and give you the paper materials. You're walking away with the binder and the dividers. It's simply an expense that with the remaining $300 we have for services and supplies through the end of June, we just can't afford. So if you'd be so kind as to follow that instruction, I won't have to send Corinne after you. We have.
And so I have probably 100 notebooks that aren't being used right now, and I'd be happy to take up a collection among the building and ship all the spare notebooks down to Legislative Council's office.
And I have that number at my home, so I'd be happy to provide those too.
Well, I don't think he's really looking for notebooks. He's being frugal, and it's much appreciated, certainly, by the chair. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other comment. We have set the prices at which we plan to sell the advance sheets of Oregon laws. Those are the paperback volumes of the Oregon laws that we produce as you adopt them, and they're filed with the Secretary of State. And we've also set the prices for the hardbound version of that, which is called the Oregon Laws. The price for the advance sheet subscription will be going up from $100 to $115, and of the Oregon Laws from $150 to $210. As a result of the increase in the use of the internet and access to laws that way, and your shifting of the effective date of most laws to January 1 following session, our sales of these publications have dropped by about two-thirds over the last 15 years or so, and because we're required to break even, the prices, the increases reflect the continuing anticipated diminution in sales, but these publications will still be available for interested citizens and are still a bargain at those prices. Thank you. The next item on your list are the carryover items on administrative rule review. Mr. McCarthy is here, has provided you with a memorandum that focuses on the issues where he was in disagreement with the Parks Department. He's going to walk you through those briefly, after which a motion to adopt Mr. McCarthy's revised report would be in order.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator Carno, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel. To the last meeting, I did present the report on ARR 17643 and mentioned that the department had responded by letter to the report and had objected to virtually all of my points, except for one or two. And this letter that you have in front of you should, as Greg said, point out, highlight the items that I continue to disagree with them on, at least continue to disagree strongly with them on. The other points are relatively minor, and I will, even though may have some minor objection to what they responded with, let go. But these four that I point out in my memo, I think, are areas of continued disagreement. The first one is that they have had a definition in their rule, which they changed from the statute, which the statute says improvement includes, and they put improvement means. I pointed out that includes is an expansive word and means is a restrictive word. And they replied back, as you can see, that if substituting means for includes is a limiting change that the statutes did not intend, it would be interesting to know what limits the statute contemplated by using the term includes. That's neither here nor there. The point is that they changed the word, and the statute doesn't have that in the definition. The second claim is a little more complicated, and I will try to be brief. Basically, it involves a definition of the state recreation area, and it's the definition of ocean shores, and the department's permitting authority of permitting the laying of pipelines and conduit over and under a state recreation area. They believe that the term state recreation area is subsumed in the definition of ocean shore, and I do not believe that is so. If you look at the ocean, waterline, wet sand area, ocean shore up to the dry vegetation line, they say that the state recreation area is between this dry vegetation line and low tide. I say that the state recreation area continues to extend beyond the dry sand area. There is a prohibition in statute on laying pipelines and conduits over a state recreation area. And there is an exemption in statutes for the area that is ocean shore. That's fine. If they are right and state recreation area is subsumed in the definition of ocean shore, then they say there's no problem. However, I disagree with that. There's specifically a statute that says they shall acquire lands that abut the ocean shore, and those areas can be a state recreation area. Well, if they abut ocean shores and it's not submerged lands, which is not intended, then it must be beyond the dry sand area. So I continue to disagree with them on that point. The third point the application process for obtaining a permit to build on ocean shores contains a provision that allows for a hearing to be held at the motion of the applicant or on 10 or more interested members of the public. The department has added a provision by which the director may, on the director's own motion, hold a hearing. I don't believe that that's contemplated in the statute. The department believes they can do this because they are defending the public interest of the state and generally believe that they have this authority in their overall authority provided to the director to enforce the director's, the laws that come within the purview of the director. And I don't think it's that clear. I can understand why they would like to have the authority to hold their own hearing, but the statute says a hearing may be held at the request of an applicant or at the request of 10 or more interested members of the public, and the director is just not contemplated in that statute. Whether it makes sense or not, or whether it's they're defending the public interest, in my opinion, is neither here nor there. And the last point is that they had they allowed for a waiver of the application fee to certain public agencies who applied for ocean shore improvements. And I pointed out that the statute provided no leeway for waivers. They had mentioned that they would either change the rule or submit legislation. At this moment, the rule has not been changed, but they did submit House Bill 2257, which has been passed by both houses and signed by the governor, and is now Chapter 25, Oregon Laws 2003, which inserts an ability of them for them to provide for fee waiver for public agencies.
Thank you. Questions? Discussion? Senator Muniz?
I mean, it looks like the fourth issue is being resolved by virtue of change of bill passage. The other three items, I assume, still at loggerheads?
Senator Carno, Senator Muniz, yes.
And Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Muniz, if the committee adopts the report as refined in Mr. McCarthy's letter dated May 30, the next step in the process will be my sending a letter to the agency pointing out the existing points of disagreement and asking the agency what the agency plans to do in response.
All right. Would you like a motion?
Yes, I would.
I move that the Council Committee adopt the May 30th, 2003 report by Mr. McCarthy.
Senator Muniz moves adoption of the report as submitted by Mr. McCarthy. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so moved. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the next item on the agenda has to do with the Public Safety Memorial Fund. There was an issue in a previous report about the statute not permitting what the department was trying to do and some desire to have the statute allow the department to do what it intended to do. And at the committee's request, Ms. Vanderbilt has identified House Bill 2238, which is in your materials, which is the bill that cures the problem. I don't know whether she has more to add to that issue or not, but that was the piece of information that the committee was asking to have.
Would anyone on the committee like to hear from?
I think it's been through the Senate Judiciary Committee, so it should be.
Senator Muniz, you don't have any questions, sir?
No, it should
concerns.
Be on the governor's desk. So,
so I'd accept a motion to accept.
You don't need to do anything.
Don't need a motion.
That was more or less just for your information.
Okay.
You also wanted Ms. Vanderbilt to report back on her having reported to the Criminal Justice Commission and Mr. Engweiler about the rule review done in response to his request for a review of what he contended and we concluded were potentially conflicting rules, and Ms. Vanderbilt has provided that information. It's again behind the green tab, and she can answer any questions you may have about it.
Okay. Chair Clarno, members of the committee, I'm Virginia Vanderbilt, Legislative Counsel's Office. I did prepare a memo that is, I believe, in your materials that I sent to Phil Lemon of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, Diane Ray of the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and Mr. Engweiler. And as you can see, I explained what the committee had done in adopting sort of our report about this conflict. And not realizing that the committee was going to meet quite so soon, I gave Mr. Lemon at the Justice Commission until August 1st to reply. I thought he might be busy doing things for you folks, and I haven't heard from him, but I'm sure I will before that deadline.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
There's no action required on that. There's also no action required on the last item that's in your materials behind the green tab, which is a memorandum from Mr. Shepard, the Deputy Attorney General, and from me to agency heads and agency rules coordinators, reminding them of the need to submit rule copies to our office within 10 days of filing the rules with the Secretary of State. We're hopeful that that reminder will spur agencies to make sure that they are continually punctual in their providing us with copies of the rules, and so far we haven't had any problems.
Okay.
The next item on your list is Roman numeral 3 sub B. These are the rule reviews behind the blue tab. These are the reviews where we've found no problems. These are not the individual reports. And at this time, it would be appropriate for there to be a motion to approve the administrative rule reports, including rules submitted from November 15, 2000 through December 29, 2000, excluding those with individual reports.
Excluding those with individual reports? Okay.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Representative Williams.
I would move the adoption of the administrative rule review reports, including rules submitted from November 15, 2000 through December 29, 2000, excluding those individual reports that are subject to the separate staff reports that the committee must take action on.
Or do you want to do them at
I'd like to do them all at once.
Okay. Then just do them through September 28, 2001. They're individual.
Would you amend your motion to read?
Oh, I would. I'm sorry.
Through December, through November 15th, 2000, through September.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's
so
fine.
It's the reports. Then I would amend my motion, Madam Chair, to extend to those administrative rule review reports from November 15, 2000 through September 28, 2001, excluding those which will require the committee to take individual action.
Representative Williams has moved acceptance of the report from November 15, 2000 through September 28, 2001, excluding the others that he mentioned. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Not so moved.
Madam Chair, the next item on the agenda is the individual staff reports, beginning with the Administrative Rule Report 18,035. The deputies are available to take you through each of these items where we do have some problem with the agency's action. I think you'll find through today's presentations that most of the problems that have been identified have been resolved through agreement with the agency or through subsequent action by this body. And Mr. McKean is up for the first one.
Hello, Mr. McKean. Yes, you introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Doug McKean, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The first rule report has to do with an Employment Relations Board rule. Employment Relations Board can have hearings on appeal from certain administrative actions dealing with public employees, state employees, disciplinary proceedings, for example, with management employees and temporary employees, discipline like demotions or dismissals and that sort of thing. The employee can request a hearing with the Employment Relations Board. They have a statute, it's 4S240.560, that says in part that such appeal shall be in writing and shall be heard by the board within 30 days after its receipt, meaning the receipt of the notice of appeal or request for an appeal. The board had adopted amendments to four separate rules. In each case, the board was giving itself the authority to grant postponements of those hearings under certain circumstances, typically when a postponement was requested by the parties and the parties agreed to the postponement. Reading the statute, which is mandatory language about the appeal shall be held within 30 days after the receipt, I wrote a report saying that I thought their rulemaking authority or their statement in their rules that they grant postponements was not authorized. They agreed with that tweeting, and they changed their rules. They amended their rules in May of 2002. As a footnote, however, they did get an AG opinion that said with respect to one of those rules, the AG thought that they did have authority to adopt such a rule to allow postponement, basing its opinion on a like situation with LUBA. I'm not sure I agree with that AG's opinion, but in any event, the agency can make a pretty good policy case for why it should have the authority to grant postponements, and so it introduced legislation to give itself that authority. The bill they introduced was House Bill 2178. It did not go anywhere, so they got an amendment to an additional bill, 2474, engrossed. That bill has been passed. It's been signed by the Speaker. It's just waiting signature of the President and the Governor, of course. But it gives them the authority to grant a postponement at the request of both parties. And would welcome your questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
A motion.
Madam Chair, I would move that we adopt the Administrative Rule Report 18035 as submitted by Council.
Representative Williams moves that we accept the report ARR 18035 as reported to us by Council. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so moved.
Madam Chair, then we now have ARR 18114 involving Department of Consumer and Business Services Building Codes Division. Mr. Taylor is here to take you through this one, and I also believe the next one after that involving boiler and pressure vessel regulations.
Chair Clarno, members, good afternoon. My name is Chuck Taylor. I'm Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I actually have the next three folks. 18114 is a DCBS rule through their Building Codes Division dealing with basically light rail type construction, such as the MAX line. And they adopted some rules, including a provision that imposed civil penalties for any violation of the rules. Mm-hmm. And that was not authorized at that time by statute. As noted in the report, they did come in during the 2001 session and had a statutory amendment done. So the problem would exist only for any violations before that took effect in January 1st, 2002. And the department essentially has agreed with our report and noted that there weren't any violations pursued under the invalid part of the rule.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Any questions, Mr. Taylor? If not, I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move the adoption of the report on AR 18114.
Representative Williams moves adoption of the report on ARR 18114. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so moved. Mr. Taylor?
ARR 18121 was a rule by the Board of Boiler Rules. It imposed a fee that was on a flat fee basis. The statute required a fee assessed at an hourly rate. The board agreed that the flat fee was improper and notified us of their intent to address that.
Thank you very much. Any questions? No, I need a motion for this report.
All right, Madam Chair, I'll move the adoption of ARR 18121.
Representative Williams moves the adoption of ARR 18121. Any discussions? Any objection? If not, so moved. Mr. Taylor?
ARR 18172 was a report on the rules of the state fire marshal. There were basically two problems identified in the report. The first one was that the rule provided for a different licensing fee depending on whether the applicant was based in state or out of state. And that raised a constitutional problem, and the agency withdrew or corrected the rule to basically flatten out the fees and make them equal. The second problem that was noted is one with which the agency disagreed with us. The statute requires that an applicant for a retail fireworks license apply to the agency at least 15 days before the scheduled event. The rule adopted by the agency, depending on where the calendar falls, would require an application to be filed at least 68 days before the event. And our position was that the words at least 15 days before the event in the statute indicated an intention that you could file up to that point or make an application up to that point. The agency's response mostly is arguing that 15 days is impractical, but I believe the first sentence of the reply could be taken as stating that their view is that the words at least 15 days establish a minimum and that the agency is somehow free to adopt a longer period if they wish to, and I would disagree with that interpretation.
Madam Chair, if I might interject at this point, this is the second time that this matter has been in front of the committee. There was an affected party that brought the problem to the attention of a prior member of the assembly who brought the matter to the committee, and as a result of that action, the committee had introduced legislation that would have taken care of the problem, making it clear that the folks who were looking to apply for these permits needed to go check with the fire marshal's rules to see if there might be a deadline that was farther out than those 15 days. Regrettably, that measure was in committee and did not receive a hearing when the speaker ordered that particular committee closed. So this particular issue might have been solved by legislation, but remains live.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Any comments? Any discussion?
What's the plan then on this, Greg? If we adopt this report as presented by Mr. Taylor, if I could, Madam Chair, then the same thing happens. We send another letter to the agency indicating that the committee's adopted the report, saying that we think that their rule adoption is inappropriate, and we schedule it for a later discussion where they'll come in and present to the committee. Is that the plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, yes, and in addition, we would likely suggest that for the 2005 session, the measure that would clarify the issue be presented again and hopefully might receive more favorable treatment.
Okay. Any further discussion? If not, I need a motion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I've moved the adoption of ARR 18172 as presented to the committee.
Representative Przanski has moved the adoption of the report on ARR 18172. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved.
And Ms. Vanderbilt is here for ARR 18,195.
Chair Clarno, members of the committee, Virginia Vanderbilt, Legislative Council's office. ARR 18195 is a report on a rule of the Department of Corrections. I pointed out a potential problem with one of the rules. This rule deals with the supervision of sexually violent dangerous offenders. ORS 144635 requires intensive supervision for the full period of a person's parole or post-prison supervision if three things are present. And those three things are that the person has to have been incarcerated for committing a particular sex crime. The person has to have been at least 18 years of age at the time the crime was committed, and the supervisory authority, which could be either the parole board or a local supervisory authority, has to have found that the person is a sexually violent, dangerous offender, as defined in the statute. In adopting the rule, the department mandates intensive supervision for this full period just upon a finding that the person is a sexually violent, dangerous offender. Those first two requirements don't need to be found. This really isn't a problem if we view the statute as sort of setting the floor, that you absolutely have to provide this intensive supervision if all three of these things are present, and we don't read it as a prohibition against imposing the intensive supervision in other situations. And I wrote the report just to sort of point that out to the department. They agreed, they indicated that they really weren't trying to expand the mandate beyond that which is contained in the statute, and they are amending the rule to bring it into compliance with that.
Questions? Discussion? Senator Minnis?
Need a motion?
I need a motion, please.
To Councilmembers approve AR 18195.
Senator Minnis moves that we approve the report 18195. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved.
Mr. McCarthy's here on 18,224.
Chair Carno, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I would like to also move up 18652, which is at the end of this list, because they are both the same rule. 18224 was the temporary rule. 18652 was the permanent rule. In both cases, the department adopted a rule which would have given the department the ability to waive a notice requirement for a state agency when it was acquiring new property. Statute requires that a state agency acquiring property notify the department so that the department can find out whether there are other state agencies that may have similar property that would suit the purposes. The department's rule allowed the department to waive that requirement under certain circumstances. I pointed that out, and they were extremely cooperative. Received a phone call back almost immediately, and they contacted their AG. They amended their rule, and it's already been passed and done.
All right. So, do you need a motion on approval of both?
Both of these, please.
All right. And Madam Chair, I would move that we approve the report ARR 18224 and ARR 18652.
Senator Minnis has moved approval of ARR 18224 and 18652. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, Mr. Cheek is now here on ARR 18,259, involving the State Board of Pharmacy.
Chair Carno, members of the committee, my name is Charlie Cheek, Deputy Legislative Counsel. ARR 18,259 is a report regarding the notice of rulemaking rule adopted by the Board of Pharmacy. The legislature has adopted ORS 183-335, which sets out requirements for state agencies when they are engaged in rulemaking. The board had adopted a rule about its own rulemaking procedures, which was not in conformity with that statute. I indicated in a memo to Gary Schnabel, the executive director of the board, that that was the case. He replied that the board would, in fact, address that in their next rulemaking effort. They have done so, and I reviewed the rule yesterday, and it is in conformity with the statute.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any discussion? If not, I need a motion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I move that we approve AAR 18259.
Senator Burdick moves we approve ARR 18259. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved.
And Madam Chair, now Ms. Vanderbilt is back to address the Oregon Youth Authority in ARR 18375.
Chair Clarino, members of the committee, Virginia Vanderbilt, Legislative Counsel's Office. ARR 18375 is a report on a rule of the Oregon Youth Authority that has to do with what the Youth Authority is supposed, how they're supposed to reply when they are asked about a record that has been expunged, a record of somebody they've had a contact with. 419A, ORS 419A262, provides that an agency that's subject to an expunction order has to respond to any inquiry by saying that no reference or record exists. ORS 419A260, which defines expunction, says that no further reference can be made to material that's subject to an expunction order except upon order of a court of competent jurisdiction. So there's kind of one little exception, which is if a court orders it. OAR 416140010 actually incorporates two exceptions. They say that basically the response is no record exists, except when a court of competent jurisdiction has ordered a different response, or when the information is required for state or federal audits. I'm not exactly sure what state or federal audits with capital letters are, but the statutes don't include that as an exception. That's what the report pointed out. The agency agreed, and they amended the rule to conform it.
All righty, thank you. Any discussion? Need a motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I move we approve AAR 18375.
Senator Burdick moves we approve AAR.
ARR.
ARR, thank you, 18,375. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, we now move on to ARR 18,397. Taylor discussing the Department of Agriculture's rulemaking rules.
Chair Clarno, members, again, Chuck Taylor, Deputy Legislative Counsel. 18397 is Agriculture Department rule, basically setting forth the rule adoption process, and it was noticed during review that an unamended part of the rule still contained the old timelines for publishing rulemaking notice in the Secretary of State bulletin. They provide for 15 days. The statute was changed to require 21 days several years back. So we pointed that out to them, and they thanked us and said they would get it changed.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Any discussion? Not. Rep. Steinberger?
Madam Chair, I move approval of AAR 18397.
Representative Berger moves approval of ARR 18397. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so moved.
Madam Chair, Ms. Vanderbilt returning for the penultimate time with the Department of Justice Victims Compensation Program.
Chair Clarno, members of the committee, I am still Virginia Vanderbilt, although I'm beginning to wish I weren't. ARR 18446 is a rule of the Department of Justice, specifically the Crime Victims Assistance Section. These rules, you know, have to do with when crime victims can apply for crime victims compensation. This particular rule establishes the procedures that the applicant has to go through to seek reconsideration of a negative determination by the department. ORS 147145 authorizes an applicant to request review, and then it requires the department to notify the applicant of its decision within 30 days. The rule said that the department could extend that 30-day period for a reply if the applicant agreed to the extension. And although that might be a good idea, the statute doesn't authorize the extension, which we pointed out, and, of course, the agency instantly agreed with our analysis and amended their rule.
Thank you. Any discussion? Need a motion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Prusansky.
I move ARR 18446 as presented to the committee.
Representative Prusansky moves ARR 18446 as presented. Any discussion? Objection? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, members, now ARR 18,559, the Child Care Division of the Employment Department, and Mr. McKean.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm still Doug McKean, Deputy Legislative Counsel. ARR 18,559 deal with rules of the Child Care Division of the Employment Department. Child Care Division certifies certain child care facilities, and it has different rules for child care facilities that have 12 or more children, different rules for child care facilities that have 12 or fewer children, or I guess fewer than 12 children. The statutes define a child to mean a child under 13 years of age. The agency's rules, however, included children who are special needs kids who are as many as 18 years old but have special needs, and they have needs that require treatment that is appropriate for kids younger than that. So the rules, the problem with that rule is that with respect to whether or not they certify a facility or which set of rules regulate the facility will be different on how they count the kids. And if they're counting kids who are over 13, which the statute talks about, then maybe the wrong set of regulations apply, or the facility will be required to be certified when under the statute it would not have to be certified. So I wrote the report giving them that information. I think they agreed with that, but they had some good reasons for allowing their child care facilities to include these kids under 18 who have special needs. And so their proposed solution was to get the statute changed. They have done that. They proposed House Bill 2191, which is now being engrossed. It has passed both houses. It's waiting for the signatures of the president and the speaker. On my right is Richard Luthy. He's the rules coordinator for the Employment Department. And if you have questions for him, he can describe to you why they chose to get the statute changed as opposed to changing their rules. And Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McKean. Questions?
Madam Chair, just move that we adopt or approve ARR 18559.
Thank you. Senator Minnis moves that we adopt ARR 18559. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so moved. Thank you, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, members, Ms. Vanderbilt returns for the last time to deal with ARR 18,623 and our problem child, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Virginia Vanderbilt. Actually, these are the days that, you know, lowly deputy legislative counsel live for. Normally, we toil in the darkness, but now here we are in public.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
ARR 18623 is a rule of the board and the department of public safety standards and training. The rules deal with private security providers. I found problems actually with quite a few of the rules that were submitted as part of this single report. There were two types of problems. Some of the problems arose because the department adopted rules right after the 2001 session was over and had them take effect right away, sort of forgetting the fact that the effective date of the legislation was January 1st, 2002. So some of the rules were premature. And when I told them that, they said, okay, they amended them so that they would take effect at the appropriate time. Those rules, I don't think that we need to deal with here because they're sort of taken care of. The second type of problems really were substantive problems. And I've categorized them in a way that I hope will make this go quickly. Terminology problems. The department defined several terms, supervisory manager being one, private security officer, alarm monitor, and designee in ways that conflicted with statutes and just didn't work statutorily. When they received this report, they agreed with all of those parts of the report and have made changes to reflect those, you know, to reflect the differences that we had. Another rule that there was a problem with was their marksmanship rule. ORS 181883 says that 70% is a minimum qualifying score for marksmanship. The rule decided that it should be 100% as the minimum, which is a pretty clear divergence, which they saw and agreed to. They introduced a House bill to raise the level to 100%. It's House Bill 2235, and it is currently in the Senate Judiciary Committee. But as I say, meanwhile, they did amend the rule to reflect the statute. Another rule we had problems with was a rule that requires private security officers, proprietary security managers, security contractors, and applicants for any of those positions to notify the department within 48 hours after being arrested or charged with a crime. The statute, however, only requires a private security officer to notify either the person's employer, or if the person isn't employed, the department. So the rule imposed a requirement on a much larger group of folks than the statute anticipated. The department agreed, they amended the rule, but once again, they, in the same bill, House Bill 2235, they proposed a legislative fix that would sort of close this loophole. The next rule that had a problem was the rules would allow a person who was licensed as a proprietary security manager or a security contractor to perform certain duties of a private security officer, even though they weren't certified. This person wasn't certified as a private security officer. Unfortunately for the department, ORS 181873 prohibits anyone from performing the duties of a private security officer unless the person is certified, so the rule was beyond the intent and scope. The department replied that it was seeking advice from its attorney general and that they would get back to us. They really didn't get back to us on that issue, but when I checked the rule just yesterday, I noticed that they must have agreed because they did go in, fact, and amend the rule to conform it to my report. There was also a problem with a compliance sort of issue rule. There was a rule that allowed the Advisory Committee on Private Security Services to bring and assess civil penalties for violations of the rules. ORS 181889, which established this advisory committee, also set out its duties, and bringing and assessing civil penalties was not something that this advisory committee was authorized to do. So the rules have been amended to restrict that practice. Finally, there was an issue with fees. ORS 181878 granted authority to adopt fees, but it provided that the fees could not exceed the basically the prorated costs of, you know, the program, of the licensing or certification program. But one of their rules had sort of a strange provision because it provided for a $50 fee to license a private security supervisory manager and a $250 fee for licensing a private security executive manager. And since this, the rules indicated that both of these classifications went through virtually the exact same process, I really didn't see how one of them could possibly cost five times more than the other. And I mentioned that in my report, and the department agreed and is amending its rules.
Thank you, Virginia. Any questions?
It's moved that we approve the report, ARR 18623.
Senator Minnis moves we approve the report, ARR 18623. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. Greg?
Thank you. Madam Chair, we now come to item D, which is an issue that comes up cyclically. Mr. McKean is here to give you additional detail on the issue if you want, but I'll try to summarize it for you. The Public Employee Benefits Board provides benefits for public employees. The Oregon Court of Appeals, in an opinion, said that if the state was providing benefits to married heterosexuals, the state also had to provide benefits to unmarried homosexual domestic partners, which PEB started covering. PEB also started providing benefits to unmarried heterosexual domestic partners. We believe that the statutes governing PEB's authority do not give the board the authority to extend benefits to unmarried heterosexual domestic partners. The Attorney General believes otherwise. We've had at least one, and I think perhaps two, extended exchanges over the years with a Deputy Attorney General and Ms. Christensen from the board here with a full airing of the issues. Each time the committee has adopted the Deputy Legislative Counsel's report on the issue, and nothing has happened, PEB just moves on following as it needs to the advice of its own lawyer, and this body has never taken action legislatively either to clearly prohibit or clearly authorize PEB's actions. So there are two reports for the committee to take action on, 18,005 and 18,651. I say Mr. McKean and Ms. Christensen are here to provide additional details if you want, but I think that provides an essential summary of where we've gone before.
Thank you, Greg. Discussion?
One question. Aren't there potential criminal penalties for expending public resources without statutory authority on the part of a public official?
Madam Chair, Senator Minnis, yes, but you amended the statute to make it clear that there has to be some intent to do that, so following one's attorney's advice would not subject one to liability.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Minnis.
I'd argue that point. I have a lot of criminal defense lawyers that tell their clients certain things that they're ultimately convicted of. And, you know, I guess by the notice given by this committee to PEB, clearly that would give them notice and an understanding that the statutes do not provide that authority. If they continue to do so, that would, in my opinion, demonstrate intent, because they're doing it knowingly. Just because the Attorney General says it's okay doesn't mean that a jury is going to agree with them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick,
has anyone done a fiscal on how much it costs to provide these benefits to unmarried heterosexual couples?
Would you like to come up, please?
You want me to make a probable cause of arrest, and we'll find out.
Down.
I think I can put a case together in a fairly short period of time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mylia Christensen, and I'm the administrator for the Public Employees Benefit Board, and I'd like to be clear, I am not a voting member of the board. however, I am here to represent some of the history and answer your question, and Senator Burdick, to answer your question, the original analysis that went along with the decision-making for the board, just to back up with a little bit, we started the new board in January of 1998. The Bargaining Unit Benefit Board, that was one of the predecessor boards, had already voted to implement domestic partner coverage. the PEB statutes required the new PEB board to take the programs of the previous boards and move forward with them in January of 1998. So the brand new board, actually, in their first month of operation, was really looking at a situation in which a previous board had voted to start the program. So they quickly conducted a series of analysis, took all the work that had been done, and then did vote to go ahead and extend coverage based on the Attorney General's advice to the Public Employees Benefit Board that, in fact, they did have the authority to extend that coverage. At the time, the fiscal work that was done indicated from an analysis that had been done across the country, others that had implemented the program, that typically enrollment was at about 1%. You could expect a 1% enrollment, and that's what PEB did experience in the first year, and we have experienced. We have about 110,000 members, and we have 1,500 domestic partners currently enrolled on the program. The original fiscal was an estimate of about $600,000 additional cost for that first year, and at this point we do not differentiate any longer. It's several years down the road, a specific costs that are associated just with that subpopulation, again for legal reasons.
Madam Chair, can you explain that last statement again for legal reasons?
Madam Chair and Senator Minnis, we don't track subpopulations of any employee groups in terms of coverage or costs of that for any particular group within PEB. So I think what we've tried to do in implementing the program is to implement the program as the board instructed us, but to have numbers available in terms of the overall program, but we don't subtract a subset of the population and try to track their costs any differently than the general population. That's what I meant to say.
Madam Chair.
Senator Minnis?
Has PEB had public discussions regarding this particular issue and whether or not the statute provides the authority, and a contrast between that and the counsel being given to them by the Attorney General?
Madam Chair and Senator Minnis, there have been many conversations. Some of those conversations have been with counsel in executive session. Some of those discussions have been public discussions of, for example, this body's feedback to PEB, which has been done in public meetings. The board has dozens of meetings throughout the year, so it has been a topic on the agenda in both the operations subcommittee and the full board meetings.
So if I issued a subpoena for your documents regarding these conversations, information that you have, would you have documents that would be subject to the subpoena?
Madam Chair, Senator Minnis, I would have to work with the Attorney General's office in terms of the response. I don't know the answer.
You don't know if there are any documents?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Minnis, there are documents. I just don't know the legal. I don't know how the request would be dealt with, so I would need to defer to some.
Well, I know how it would be dealt with, but.
Madam Chair.
Just a moment, Representative Brzezinski. Senator Minnis, are you through? Or do you want to come
for
back?
For the time being.
Okay.
I'm not finished, but I'm through.
Representative Brzezinski.
I was just going to ask counsel, based on what's being presented to us, can you just walk us through what the next procedure or steps would be? I would assume if we have the opportunity to adopt this report, what would happen next?
Madam Chair, Representative Brzezinski, we'll send a letter to Ms. Christensen saying we don't think you're authorized to have this rule, and what do you plan to do about it? She'll send me a nice short letter back saying the Attorney General thinks we do, and therefore we're going to keep doing what we've always done.
We've been here, we've done that. In other words, this is the same response that has been received by the committee previously?
Madam Chair, Representative Brzezinski, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Richardson?
Madam Chair, Ms. Christensen, am I correct that you said that this determination that domestic partners should be covered was first made in January of 1998?
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, there were actually several decisions that were made. The first one was actually before PEB even began, by the Bargaining Unit Benefit Board in late 1997. The new PEB board met in the first quarter of 1998, made a preliminary decision to implement the domestic partner coverage. At that time, there was the lawsuit that was taking place, which was the Tanner decision that Mr. Chamoff mentioned earlier, that actually was a statewide discussion on the same issues of same-gender coverage for domestic partners. The board stayed their decision to implement domestic partners until the outcome of that case. The case was determined, I believe, in the second quarter of the year, and when the Tanner case outcome was basically a requirement that same-sex domestic partners be covered in the state of Oregon, the board went ahead and implemented the program. So there were actually a series of discussions, but it did occur in 1998.
Follow-up?
Another question?
At the time that took place, we had ORS 243.105, which defined what a family member was. And so it seems to me that what you're saying is the PEB board, as early as 1997, was making decisions that were contrary to Oregon revised statutes, and that they're continuing to make decisions that are contrary to Oregon revised statutes or recommendations from this committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm not sure how much has been provided to the committee in the way of background, and if there's a lot more detail that's requested, I think it might be appropriate to have the Attorney General come back with me to answer some of the specific questions. But in the findings of the Attorney General's advice to PEB, those same statutes and the broad authority that PEB had as granted by the legislature, the Attorney General's office came to a different conclusion than legislative counsel came to. So they believed in their interpretation of those statutes that the board did have the authority to define family members to include domestic partners. And I believe that's the essence of the disagreement between the legal opinions.
And Madam Chair, if I could just give a brief historical note, and I know other members of the committee who have served for some sessions on Legislative Council Committee will recall that at one point the Deputy Attorney General at that time, who was Mr. Schumann, appeared in front of this committee, and there was a lengthy discussion with Deputy Attorney General Schumann about the Attorney General's office's interpretation of the Tanner decision and the applicability of the constitutional provisions vis-a-vis these particular statutes that are being raised. So we've gone down the path with that office at least once in a full-blown hearing in front of this committee, and that was the result. And fundamentally, if, you know, our option when we get into this kind of a shooting match with the executive in the legislative branch, our option is to try to find a way to change the statute in a way that would be constitutional if the court decided to interpret it if a case got there. So we can haul everybody in and sort of you know, take them through the process, but ultimately our choice is, if the executive disagrees with us on this issue, is to put through some sort of statutory change.
Well, thank you. And I had Senator Beyer and then Senator Minnis, and I'll come back to you, Representative Richardson. I realize you didn't get through. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me if I'm still on the Public Employee Benefit Board?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe, as far as I know, you are.
Oh, cool.
Wow. I'm not sure which is more damning, that you didn't know.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to find out who Senator Minnis is planning on arresting.
It only takes one to get a test case.
Senator Minnis, do you plan on arresting Senator Beyer?
No, go ahead. No, I'm going to arrest Senator Beyer, because clearly he has no knowledge.
Thank you, I think.
Senator Minnis. Were you finished, Senator Beyer? Senator Minnis.
I just want to follow up on Senator Representative Williams' discussion. Has there been an introduction of legislation to change the statute to codify what PEB's doing or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Minnis, are you asking me?
You're not.
There has been no legislation that's been introduced by PEB, and I believe they're not related to PEB, but there's been other legislative activity around the issue, but not specific to PEB during this session or last session that I'm aware of.
Okay. Follow up, Senator Minnis.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't mind having Hardy Meyer sit here and tell me about PG, even whether the language is clear or not, and, you know, listen to his, you know, diatribe on why he thinks that, you know, the Tanner decision somehow justifies the executive branch, you know, disregarding the statute. And I think it's even more blatant when they haven't bothered to introduce legislation and bring the issue before the legislature. Because if that is, in fact, the remedy, and they fail to do it, knowing full well that the controversy exists, I think that's negligence in and of itself.
Thank you, Senator Minnis. Representative Richardson, I'll come back to you, and then Senator Burdick.
Okay. Only had just one final one to follow up with, Madam Chair, and Ms. Christensen, and that was that we understand that you're just here representing the situation. We're trying to get to the bottom of it, and your response basically focused after the Tanner decision, and yet what my comment was relating to was both before and after, because the PIB's original decision to cover domestic partners would have been in direct contradiction of the statute, and it was before there was an appellate court decision holding otherwise. And so I'm just wondering, because I'm new here, whether or not there is a kind of an ongoing independent spirit with PEB since 1997 that may be continuing to this day.
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, a couple things. I think you're correct that the board voted to extend domestic partner benefits in advance of the Tanner decision outcome, and then decided to hold that decision until the outcome was known of the Tanner case. Their rationale for implementing it in part had to do with the analysis and research that they had done and a lot of the work that they did, which was based on the board's belief of the authority and confirmed by the Attorney General's office that they had the authority to consider that. So I don't know if that helps.
Yeah.
The decision, although they were tracking very closely with the Tanner decision and were awaiting the outcome of the decision, the work and focus and analysis that they were doing was really on a track that was related in part because of the previous board's motion and in part because of their movement and actions to take it forward.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick?
Thank you. I just wanted to find out how or if these insurance coverage decisions are incorporated into collective bargaining agreements. Do the collective bargaining agreements with the state employees specifically mention its level of coverage, or how is that even a factor here?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, the collective bargaining agreements that relate to benefits do have in the collective bargaining agreements dollar amounts that are negotiated as part of collective bargaining that actually are the funds that pay for benefits. The portion of the, or the role rather, that the Public Employees Benefit Board has is to design the benefit program and to negotiate and administer the programs with the carriers. So there are a couple different levels of decision making. The collective bargaining component of it covers the dollar amounts. PEB does the role of designing and purchasing and administering. So in this case, for example, the discussions with the carriers to allow domestic partners to be covered under the program in terms of the definition of dependents under the program was one of the things that the board worked on. Okay. And then this just to add one more, the state did move forward in terms of the actual funding so that domestic partners were funded the same as spouses were.
Okay, again, this may be a question that can be addressed to the Attorney General as well, but to your knowledge, there is not a specific guarantee of this kind of coverage in the agreements themselves. In other words, we might be dealing with a different interpretation, but we're not, as far as you know it, dealing with contract law here.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I would need to defer to somebody on the labor side to answer that question.
Okay, pardon me?
I was going to move approval.
I have one more member that wants to respond, then I'll take your motion, Senator Minnis. Representative Ackman?
Yes, I'm kind of worried if we don't follow the recommendation of Legislative Council and merge our decision with that of the Attorney General, and the coverage is extended. I wonder if we're not mooting out a potential lawsuit regarding the application of the statute or the extension of Tanner. And I'm kind of wondering about, not that we would exceed our role, but whether our role should be one of trumping a court decision on something so vital as the issue that's before us.
Greg, would you like to respond to that?
Madam Chair, I would, but I don't understand.
Well, I think...
I want to clarify that.
I'm wondering what type of a record we're making. If we go along with the Attorney General's opinion that the coverage is extended, would we be precluding any lawsuit which would be designed to interpret the statute and or arguably extend Tanner.
Madam Chair, Representative Ackerman, no, what you all decide doesn't matter.
I'm glad to hear that. Glad to be here.
I personally think we're accepting a report more than we are approving any actions taken by the PET board. Senator Minnis?
Yes, sir. I do think there is a record being established that shows intent and knowledge. And whether it's criminal or civil, there are some civil actions. I think the Legislative Assembly could take to court and ask the court to resolve the controversy. I find it somewhat disheartening that the PEP hasn't introduced legislation to try to resolve the issue, to just simply ignore it and not bring the issue to the legislature and have the legislature review it. To me, is just thumbing their nose at previous discussions. I find that repulsive. But, you know, that's the way it goes sometimes. So I would move adoption or approval of the current report, and I don't remember the number off the top of my head here.
Senator Minnis moves the adoption of ARR 18005. Pardon me?
Can we do both of them at the same time?
Do both of them at the same time. Senator Minnis, is that all right in your motion? Also adoption of the report of ARR 18651. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. And Senator Minnis, staff, Legislative Council, if we could at a future date for the next council meeting have someone or have the Attorney General be here to respond to some questions you asked.
It might also be a good idea to bring Kerry Weeks in.
Okay.
Yes, and ask him why his agency has to try to resolve it legislatively.
Through legislation. Yes. Okay, Greg, next item.
Madam Chair, members, the next item is a discussion of a Department of Human Services rule. We haven't logged that rule in yet for a formal review like the rules that you've been reviewing because it's too new, but Ms. Robinson has evaluated the rule and her findings are behind the last green tab. Unless you have different colors than I do.
I have a different color, I think.
So, all right, sorry.
Some of us got
it's the next to last tab.
It's under LC 3607, right?
That's correct.
We're all on the clear side.
Okay. Holly, go ahead, please. Put your name on the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. In part to bring new members up to date, as a result of action taken by the last Legislative Assembly, the Department of Human Services was directed to adopt a practitioner-managed prescription drug plan, which I describe essentially as a voluntary formulary for individuals who receive health services on a fee-for-service basis. This voluntary formulary is a list of drugs that have been determined by through a process between the department and the Health Services Commission for drugs that are supposed to be the most effective and the best price. The legislation that was passed very specifically said that a practitioner may prescribe any drug that the practitioner believes is appropriate or is medically necessary for an enrollee as being the most effective available, which is why this is being described as a voluntary formulary. Soon after the legislation passed, the department adopted rules adopting a PDL or a practitioner-managed prescription drug plan. It's a very long title, in part because Senator Minnis liked all of those words, but I sometimes have a hard time getting them out.
Meaning and intent.
We had many discussions about those five words. In the spring of this year, however, the Department of Human Services adopted a notice of proposed rulemaking that would, in fact, attempt to modify the rule that had been adopted the year previously. And in their summary, they indicate that the changes that they want to make are to strengthen the exception process for drugs not covered on the planned drug list. I was asked to look at this to determine whether or not it was within the scope of the legislation, and clearly the intent of the legislation was to in no way allow for the strengthening of an exception process. There is not to really be an exception process, and that a practitioner should have the authority to prescribe whatever drug they wanted. So I was asked to write an opinion to that effect, which I did for Senator Minnis, and I think you have that in front of you.
Any discussion, Senator Minnis?
The only thing I would add is, I mean, one of the reasons that I insisted on the name practitioner managed was that it was to be practitioner managed, and that it was the physician who had the ability to choose which medications their patient needed and which were most appropriate. The disagreement is that the department apparently believes that a pharmaceutical benefit management company may be able to save them money, and I think in our current budget scenario they're assuming a $12 million savings from the use of a pharmacy benefit management company. But I think what they're doing is clearly contrary to the law, and I think it's evidenced by Ms. Robinson's reports.
Thank you, Senator. Any further discussion? Thank you, Holly. We need a motion on this report.
Madam Chair, because this isn't part of the regular administrative rule review process, we haven't had the usual give and take from the agency, or the agency having the opportunity to consult with the Attorney General about an appropriate response to Ms. Robinson's opinion. I think that the intention of placing this on the agenda was to simply bring the matter to your attention and to the public's attention. And at this stage, I would simply acknowledge receipt of Ms. Robinson's opinion and move on to the service recognition awards.
Okay, I think we'll definitely do that and acknowledge receipt of this report. I would assume we've had nothing really substantial from the agency.
I don't know what Representative Williams.
Representative Williams.
I'm sorry.
Holly's just spoken to us about this report. And do you have any comments on it at all?
No, not specifically, except that it seemed to me that considering the fact that we are in sort of the legislative session and we've got indications that, as indicated in this letter, that this particular administrative rule has got a problem and is outside the statute, the committee at least would want to be aware of that, particularly because of the import of this rule, and that we would at least want to make the legislature aware that there is an issue of dispute here. It seems reasonable to me that we would want to sort of not have this go on for another 2 years while we wait to come back into a special session before, or a regular session before we can do something about it, if in fact something needs to be done.
Do we intend to revisit this issue prior to the end of this session?
Madam Chair, I think given the number of administrative rule reviews that are still needing the committee's review, it would be extremely unlikely for the committee to get to that rule review without staying here substantially longer than we and you would like to be here.
Well, that would apply to yesterday, Senator Minnis.
I'd just like to let the committee know there are discussions ongoing with the department, the governor's office, and others with respect to some potential resolution. However, it's been to some degree an uphill battle because of the fiscal situation, and I think the assumption that I mentioned earlier about a $12 million savings that's assumed in the budget, I think there's a significant review of whether or not that $12 million and that assumption is accurate or not, and whether there are other methodologies that might be available to save money within the prescription drug program that would not violate the intent of the law. So I think there is some hope that that can be resolved legislatively this session. So.
Thank you for that information, Senator Minnis. Okay, we'll go on to the presentation of service recognition awards.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is the portion of the meeting at which we have the opportunity to recognize the longstanding employees of the office, as I've emphasized in the past and will continue to do so at every opportunity. These are the folks who get the work done for you, their longevity, their willingness to stick to and through this process is of substantial benefit, particularly through the experience that they gain. And it's with great pride and pleasure that we're able to present awards to recognize that long service. We begin with five-year awards. The employees are listed on the last page of your notebook. We'll skip the first one and go to Mr. Cheek, if he'd be so kind as to either stand or come forward or whatever he feels inclined to do. Charlie Cheek is Deputy Legislative Counsel. He is our lottery, economic development, workers' compensation, health professionals expert. When I get ready to present the awards, I ask people what it is they'd like me to tell the committee about them. Charlie said he would like me to tell you that he's a good guy who works hard and knows a little bit about baseball. he came to us after a stint in private practice. Before that, he was the executive director of a nonprofit organization, and before that, a boat builder, and is one of a couple of people on the staff who, in the infinite spare time that you allow him, teaches college. Charlie has been here now 5 years, and I don't have my glasses on, and even if I did, I'm not sure I'd know what Ms. Robinson is holding as his reward for having survived those years. Perhaps you could tell us.
He gets a beautiful card holder, but we can't afford any cards for him. He saved another 5 years.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Next, we have Brendan McCarthy. Brendan is our natural resources lawyer. He joined us in the 1997 session as the bill digester and has been here ever since. What I was told to tell you was, quote, I'm a pretty boring person, I think. he is an avid dragon boater, a home remodeler, and soon, we hope, not too soon, or that you leave soon. He's to be a first-time parent, and therefore to be enjoying the benefits of that experience rather than your company. And he gets another coveted card hole. Let's see, Doug McKean. Mr. McKean is our support enforcement, domestic relations, labor law, public contracting attorney. Prior to joining us, he was with the Bureau of Labor and Industries for 15 years, principally as an administrative law judge. He has had a varied employment career. He's pumped gas. He's pulled lanyards on artillery. He's worked in a mill. He is, as he says, dying to go on vacation. You may take that as a hint. And is also one of the folks who, in his spare time, educates college students. Thank you, Doug.
Counsel, before you go on to the tenure awards, I think it is appropriate, and staff asked that I say something about you for your 5 years of service here in the Legislative Counsel's office. Those of you who might not know, some of you maybe do, that Mr. Chamoff worked at the illustrious Portland law firm of Miller, Nash, Weider, Hager, and Carlson, and was actually the person that was most responsible for me being hired when I was a young, fresh out of law school person. So it's only fair play that in our career, I once worked for him, and now he works for me, and I find that to be delightful. Greg came to us, obviously, at Legislative Counsel's office, having been the head of the Special Litigation Unit at the Attorney General's office. And has been, I think, just a great worker here in the Legislative Counsel's office, and has done a lot, I think, to enhance the office and morale at a time when, because of retirements and many other things, we had a lot of long-term employees who were phasing out of the Legislative Counsel's office, and we know how hard he works in in his spare time. He tells me he likes to write, but I never get to read anything he writes. He's an avid Oregon and Northwest historian, and from what I see on his lunch hour, a pretty decent dog walker. So, let's congratulate Greg on his career.
Thank you.
I would like to say on behalf of the staff in the office that to those of you who were here and hired Greg, we're very glad you did. He's good for you. He's very good for us. And we hope that you'll get a tenure award in 5 years.
Thank you. Very nice. Thank you very much. Now, speaking of tenure awards, Mr. Peters. I told Mr. Peters that I thought we'd be done right about 2:30, or that we'd hope to get through things as quickly as possible, because in addition to being here 10 years, he's been in the world many more years, and this is his birthday.
Oh, my goodness.
Dave is a senior editor team leader. I asked him what he wanted the committee to know, and he said nothing. Which is fairly typical of the folks in the publication services section. You all deal a great deal with the attorneys and likely have very little interaction with the folks who are in fact doing a great deal, if not the lion's share of the work on making your concepts, I very carefully omitted an adjective, intelligible to everyone, workable. Dave is someone who has been with us now since the 1993 session, has risen through the office to the point where he not only does his own work expertly, but also supervises others. In his prior life, he was a newspaper reporter in Portland and in the Dalles, and we've been very pleased that he's chosen to spend so many of the last years with us. Thank you, David.
Thank you. It's a beautiful pen for correcting our graph.
And Cindy Hunt. Cindy is a senior deputy legislative counsel. She is our education expert. What she told me was that she is, quote, more boring than Brendan. She has stray kittens to adopt if anyone doesn't have enough as part of this process. She had what I think was probably the best work background for coming to work here. She put herself through college as a shepherd and now spends her time in her home in Kaiser doing gardening. Thank you very much.
Before we adjourn, I certainly would like to add my comments to those of Representative Williams. Greg, we appreciate you and your staff very much. And to those of you who've been here 5 years, thank you for your hard work and dedication. And for those of you who've been here 10 years, I hope you'll stay longer, but if you don't, I certainly understand. Anything further to come before the committee? If not, thank you all.
Thank you very much.